basically 6 questions that I hope to address. First, I want to motivate why we want to test gravity on cosmic scales when we know it so well within the solar system and on small scales. Then I want to talk about, given we might think about deviations from general relativity on cosmic scales, how might one modify gravity? How can we motivate it? And then I want to talk about how, if we were to modify gravity, how that might affect the growth of structure on cosmic scales. So how it changes the growth of inhomogeneities and in the overdensities. What observations we can use to probe these modifications. And then talk about this current work that I'm doing, which is to say, what are the current constraints on modifications to gravity on cosmic scales? And then think about what the future holds. So if we think about testing gravity, then obviously on the solar system scales, we know that there are exquisite tests of general relativity or gravity that show it's very consistent with general relativity. So this is a little plot by Chiba showing the the general relativity or parameters that describe gravity and how it deviates from general relativity. And here you can see that they deviate from unity to a fraction of a percent or less. We have other early time constraints on general relativity or gravity, looking at how it affects nuclear synthesis. So if we have a change in the gravitational constant, it'll affect the expansion history of the universe through the Friedmann's equation. And at nuclear synthesis, that can have a significant effect on the primordial abundances. And so this is some work done by Kofi Davis and Krauss a few years ago now, looking at how a change in the gravitational constant could affect the predicted abundance of deuterium. And you can see that basically you get roughly about a 20% constraint on the Newton's constant from this expansion history. However, these things don't necessarily think about how gravity behaves on cosmic scales at late times. And the main motivation for thinking about testing gravity on cosmic scales nowadays is because we might think about modifications to gravity driving the recently seen cosmic acceleration of the universe. And one of the things that I'm interested in is how we might use cosmic observations to distinguish between whether the cosmic acceleration arises because of a modification to gravity or some other, either a cosmological constant or some new type of matter. And this is a particularly exciting time to think about this because in the next decade or next 5 to 10 years, we're going to have a whole load of surveys pushing both deeper and wider that are going to give us a much richer data set with which to test some of these questions. So if we think about cosmic acceleration as being motivation for testing deviations from general relativity on cosmic scales, then so as with Dragon this morning, there's probably many more cosmologists in this audience than I had expected, so I apologize for the simplistic introduction, but just so we're all on the same page, we can think about the dark energy or cosmic acceleration problem being evidence of a modification to Einstein's theory of gravity, Einstein's equation. So on the left-hand side here, we have the gravity sector, and on the right-hand side, we have the matter sector. And the question is, what is broken here in order to resolve the discrepancy between general relativity and its predictions for deceleration in a universe that's populated by normal matter and our observed acceleration? So one of the possible things is to think about a modification to the right-hand side of this equation through adding in some extra stuff, some extra matter that can drive acceleration. Another alternative is that we are interpreting cosmic acceleration under the assumption of isotropy and homogeneity, and maybe it is the breaking of isotropy and the introduction of inhomogeneities in particular that might modify how we have to interpret the averaging of densities on cosmic scales. And maybe it's that introduction of inhomogeneity that leads us to interpret cosmic acceleration where there is none. We could add to a cosmological constant on either side of this equation, either as a fundamental cosmological constant or as some extra vacuum energy. And the one that I'm particularly interested in is modifying this left-hand side modifying the theory of gravity. And one of the questions, a question that I'm interested in answering is, can we distinguish whether acceleration is driven by a modification to the left or the right-hand side? Okay, so given this motivation, how might one modify gravity? So if we think about modifying gravity in terms of thinking about modifying an effective action for the theory, then we can start off with the effective action of general relativity in terms of just the normal Einstein-Hilbert action. And if we were thinking about trying to drive, use a modification to gravity to drive early cosmic acceleration in the form of inflation, then we could think about adding additional terms, higher order terms, like an r squared term, r cubed term, in the high curvature regime in the early universe. And that's something that people have done to drive inflation. We're thinking now about modifying this on the large scale, so in the infrared regime. That's somewhat harder to do. But in terms of thinking about toy models, phenomenological models that people have considered, one is to do the analogy to that. So rather than having r squared inflation in the early universe as a UV modification, now you're thinking about having an IR modification by having additional terms in the Ricci scalar, which have to become dominant in the low curvature regime. Others are more general, a sort of generalization of that, so scalar tensor gravity, having effectively the Newton's constant now not being constant, but being driven by some additional scalar that's being introduced to give a time and potentially scale dependent Newton's constant. Or you can think about gravity coming from a higher dimensional theorem or higher dimensional theory. So for example, the model that is commonly used as an instructive model or a toy model is the Dvalli-Gapodadze-Imperati DGP model, where you have five-dimensional gravity. And so you have a five-dimensional metric and a five-dimensional Newton's constant, and then you're looking at the effective theory in four dimensions. So what does this do in terms of modifying our picture of how the universe evolves? Well, we know that the issue surrounding trying to explain cosmic acceleration arises because general relativity plus normal matter predicts that the universe should be decelerating. So if we take Einstein's equations and apply them in an isotropic and homogeneous universe, then the right-hand side here is always negative, and we need deceleration. So we need to modify Einstein's equations. So as an example, if we have F of R gravity, or some modified gravity where you have additional terms of the Ricci scalar and higher order metric terms, then you're basically modifying the left-hand side so that you can reconcile this discrepancy between the observed acceleration and the predicted deceleration that you would get from normal matter. And an example of this is F of R gravity, where I've just shown the two modified Friedmann and acceleration equations here, so that you basically have the function that you would introduce in that modified action comes in into the Friedmann equation, changing the expansion history, and allows you to reconcile the acceleration that you observe with the negative contribution from the normal matter through the function and its derivatives. Okay, so if we have such an array of possible models to consider how we might modify gravity, how does that affect the growth of structure? The reason why I'm interested in this is because if you think about how these theories modify the expansion history, they can just be mimicked entirely by constructing an additional type of matter with a strange evolution history that could give you exactly the same observational constraints. The difference is going to be that when we think about how each of those two scenarios affects the growth of structure, they're different. And so if we can contrast how the gravity behaves in terms of how it seeds large-scale structure and how gravity drives the cosmic expansion history, then we might be able to get an answer as to whether it's the left-hand side or right-hand side of Einstein's equations that are modified. So let's, given that we can basically reconstruct the expansion history in any which way we like, let's assume that we have a cosmic expansion history that's entirely consistent with the observations, so like a lambda CDM model. But now we can think about having a different growth structure history. So let's introduce inhomogeneities into perturbations into the metric in terms of, I'm just going to use the Newtonian gauge here, where these small fluctuations in the metric are going to be determined, and how they evolve is going to be determined by this new theory. Well, so again, this is for a general audience, but if we have this modified theory, then we're going to be modifying the left-hand side of Einstein's equations. But the right-hand side, i.e. how the matter evolves, is going to be unmodified. So I'm going to assume that matter is minimally coupled to gravity. In that way, then we can just use the conservation equations to think about how the matter evolves, given a certain gravitational theory. So we're going to think about how the overdensities in matter evolve, parameterized by this parameter delta. And we're going to think about how matter moves within the local gravitational potential in terms of the peculiar velocity fluctuations. So these are the deviations from the Hubble flow caused by the motion of particles or matter in the presence of local inhomogeneities or local gravitational potential wells. And I'm going to use this parameter theta to describe that, which is just basically the gradient of the peculiar velocity field. So as I said, we can use conservation of energy momentum to talk to describe how the overdensities and the peculiar velocities evolve as a function of time, given a certain potential phi and psi. It's just the normal fluid equations written here. And so these are going to be unchanged if we just assume that gravity, well, the form of these is going to be unchanged if we assume it's only gravity that's modified. When we think about modifying gravity, then we have to think about how the perturbed Einstein equations are affected. And so there's two key properties encoded in the Einstein relationships that we need to think about describing in a modified theory. So here we have, in general relativity, what the perturbed Einstein equations look like. First of all, we have the Poisson equation that relates how the space-space perturbation in the metric is related to the overdensity. And here I've written it in terms of this capital delta here, which is basically what the overdensity in a particular component of the matter I is in the rest frame of, in its own rest frame, i.e. where the peculiar velocity is zero. And it's related to any general frame moving with respect to that rest frame, just in terms of the overdensity and the peculiar velocity in this way, where W here is the equation of state. So first of all, we've got the Poisson equation. So that basically tells you, in the presence of any given overdensity, what the gravitational, the net distortion to the gravitational metric is going to be. And then secondly, we have a relationship between the time-time and the space-space components of that metric that says that in the absence of any anisotropic shear stresses, so any stresses that can convey frictional forces in a longitudinal way into a transverse motion, those two potentials are going to be identical or equivalent. Now, anisotropic shear stresses are conveyed principally in fluids that are relativistic, so in photons or relativistic massless neutrinos. They are negligible when it comes to pressureless, non-relativistic species. So in the early universe, in the radiation matter-dominated era, these anisotropic shear stresses can be important, and these two potentials would not be equivalent, but at late times, we expect them to basically be one-to-one matching if general relativity holds. So how could we think about, rather than looking at a specific model, introducing a phenomenological model that's consistent with a metric theory that could help us to investigate the constraints on a modification to gravity coming from large-scale structure? Well, one parameter, and I'll motivate these in terms of specific theories in a second, one thing you can do is modify the Poisson equation by modifying the relationship between the potential potential and the presence of matter. Basically, you can either choose to accentuate or suppress the gravitational potential that arises given a local distribution of matter with this Q parameter. Now, we can mimic Q, as I'll talk about in a little while, obviously by having extra dark components that are clustering that we aren't able to see. So if we have cold dark matter, baryons, and either there's an additional dark component, say a clustering dark energy, or if the cold dark matter growth history is modified from the way we expect it to, for some unknown reason, for example, it's got a non-minimal interaction with some other type of matter, for example, then the only way we would, because we wouldn't be able to directly see that dark component, we could infer that that change to the evolution history of the gravitational potentials, it acts exactly like a modification to gravity. So this in itself isn't necessarily a smoking gun of seeing, you know, Q not equal to 1 here. When Q equals 1, we just recover general relativity. It's not exactly a smoking gun, but it's something to look for. The second thing we could do is to think about an inequality between those two Newtonian potentials. So if we see an inequality between those two, then an alternative explanation for this might be that we have introduced additional shear stresses in a new fluid component. However, it's exceptionally hard to do this because, as I said, we would need to have a significant relativistic additional dark component in order for us to be able to see significant late time shear stresses if you were trying to explain this through having a fluid picture of this modification. And you cannot sustain such shear stresses if you think about this consistent fluid picture. And so if you were to see a deviation between these two potentials coming out of the data, then that is a more of a smoking gun that we've got modification on the left-hand side of Einstein's equations and not the right. Yep.
So you're modifying the perturbation equation, but you're not, what are you saying about that?
So what I'm saying is that if you think about having a modified gravity theory, effectively what's been shown is that, so for the F of R gravity models and for scalar tensor theories, you can basically tune that theory to give an identical background expansion history to a cosmological constant. So in theory, you could tune that function to be consistent with that. However, were you to do that, it's not necessarily the case that you would then automatically get a growth of prediction for the growth of structure that was entirely consistent with lambda CDM. So what I'm saying is that I'm going to assume that my background expansion history is effectively, you know, consistent with the lambda CDM, which we know fits it very well. And then I'm going to try and see how much leeway there is in the growth of, in the constraints on the growth of structure. And the idea is, at the moment, what we do is combine everything together to get a net constraint. But in the future, what we want to do is compare the two and to find if there's any evidence for an inconsistency. Yeah.
It's early to point us out that there are two problems with potential problems with the scalar tensor because of the freedom of solar system, the standard work. Unless you very fine tune Bopping constant. And also the F of R, they're all unstable with one exception. F of R is R.
Right?
And so then it just becomes too overdramatic. So then you're back into the problem of agreeing with Cassini.
So you'll note that when I was talking about models, I talked about them being instructive models rather than fundamental theories. I think there is definitely a long way to go in trying to get a fundamental theory. I think with regards to solar system tests, you can, with the F of R theories, you can use chameleon mechanisms to evade Gram-Zwicky constraints. And there are a range of F of R theories that are unstable, but there are others that aren't. So Wayne Hu and collaborators looked at some that are dynamically unstable, certainly. But I'm not advocating any particular model here. What I'm advocating is the concept that we should be using observations to test the principle of whether We can use them to see whether there's any evidence of deviations, and then we actually need to work a lot harder to try and figure out what the fundamental theory might be. Okay, so here's a couple of theoretical examples that and how they fall into this framework. So this is the Diwali, Gabadati, and Bharati model. And this is a roughly, not perfectly, but a roughly scale-independent modification to the Einstein equation. So in terms of these two parameters, R and Q, basically how they evolve as a function of time is principally determined by the expansion history. And how the expansion history is modified by the presence of this five-dimensional gravity that is triggered at large scales. So basically on scales greater than this cutoff scale, LC, which is determined in the theory by a ratio of the five to four-dimensional Planck masses, on larger scales than that, you're going to see this effective five-dimensional theory. And this is just showing you a couple of figures from some work by Wade here at Ignacy Sawicki a couple of years ago, showing you the modification in, so this is basically looking at something like 1 plus R. It's just dependent on Q and R as you evolve with time for three different scales. So you can see this late time deviation in the Einstein equations. Similarly, here's F of R gravity and how this is now a scale and time dependent modification. So I'm just writing down the Q parameter here. The R parameter is somewhat trickier. But again, here's just a pictorial representation of an example of one F of R theory, which is consistent with the background expansion history of constraints, but gives you very different deviations in how the perturbed Einstein equations evolve as a function of time. Okay, so there's been a lot of recent work in the last couple of years, some of which I've done with my collaborators, looking at how we might be able to test modifications to gravity using future surveys. So things like LSST, the Dark Energy Survey, DES, and any future JDEM mission, although the form of that will be still uncertain. And the idea is to, as I mentioned, rather than looking at specific theories, try and think about a phenomenological model which we can use to get some insight into whether observations will be able to tell us anything about whether gravity is deviating from general relativity on cosmic scales. And then you can get some predictive power for how well each of the relative surveys might do. But what this work that I'm talking about today is basically thinking about benchmarking the current constraints of what current observations can tell us about how gravity behaves on cosmic scales. So that we can put the future aspirations for surveys in that context. So this is the model that I've been using to investigate the current constraints. So as I mentioned, F of R theories and scalar tensor theories have been shown that you can basically reconstruct the form of that theory to give you an entirely degenerate background history to lambda CDM. So let's assume that that's the case. In our theory, we can give a good agreement with the background expansion history, and then think purely about what the additional constraints are from the greater structure. So we have a model, basically the same model parameterization for each of these two modifications to the Einstein equations. And basically what we're allowing is that we have a time-evolving piece, so we can either have it as time-independent or time-dependent. We can have some scale dependencies, so below some, on small scales, below some critical scale, we basically get exponential suppression of the modification and we can recover general relativity. This is a property that we see in some of the theories, so with F of R and DGP, to some extent, you're able to recover, you can recover general relativity on certain smaller scales, so let's include that as a possible way. And so this opens up, by using this parameterization, it opens up a way to investigate a number of different effects. First of all, we can just have a time-independent evolution so that we're modifying growth on all scales at all times and think about what the constraints are there. And the second is to think about dark energy-motivated theory, think about what the constraints are if this effect is modified at late times. Okay, so now I just want to think about the various observables that we can use. Observations that we can use to constrain the growth history. So there are three primary sets of observations that I'm going to use. The first is the amplitude of the growth assessment effect. And this is basically the effect that is imprinted on the CMB photons as they pass through an evolving gravitational potential well. So if you have a static potential well, a photon, as it falls into the gravitational well, will gain energy and be blue-shifted, and then as it climbs out, it will be equally red-shifted. Okay, so there will be no net imprint of that path imprinted on the CMB. However, if the gravitational potential is evolving or decaying over time, then the energy that that photon has coming out of the potential may be different from that at the beginning. And therefore, you have basically have to take a time or an integral over the history of that path and the gravitational potential's evolution over that time in order to see what the photon energy is, and that's the integrated set full effect. The second is to look at the number of galaxies as an indicator of the number and strength of the gravitational potential wells. And the final thing is to look at the amplitude of weak lensing shear distortions, so how the light from distant galaxies is distorted by the gravitational potential wells of foreground halos. And the thing that has started to develop in the last few years and is going to be more powerful in the years to come is not only using the autocorrelation, so the correlations between ISW-ISW, galaxy-galaxy, or lensing-lensing, but using cross-correlations between the different observations, between different surveys, in order to break some key degeneracies. Okay, so I'm just going to talk about the three different data sets or types of data that I'm going to use. The first is to constrain the background expansion history. So these don't tell us anything about, or the way in which I'm using them, not telling us anything about the growth of structure, they're principally just telling us about the expansion history of the universe. So the CMB angular diameter distance from the latest WMAP data, supernovae luminosity distances, so I'm using the Supernovae Cosmology Project union data set of all the data, all the supernovae that were up to that point, plus some additional 100 supernovae from Hicken et al. From just a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, and the baryon acoustic oscillation angular scale as from both the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and the 2DF joint analysis that was done by Will Percival et al. The second set of data tells us about the growth of structure up to some unknown bias. So bias relating the observed distribution of luminous matter to the total halo mass. So with this, I'm using galaxy autocorrelations from the latest Sloan release, and I'm using some also galaxy ISW cross-correlations that were done by Shirley Ho and collaborators using Sloan survey and two mass data. And then finally, we have set observations that are sensitive to the total gravitational potential well, so not just looking at the luminous matter. And this is the cosmic microwave background integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, the autocorrelations in WMAP, and the weak lensing autocorrelations. And I'm using the publicly available data from the Cosmos survey as it was analyzed in 2007. Okay, so how are each of these observables affected by modifications to gravity? So as I mentioned, the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect is basically sensitive to changes in the gravitational potential as a function of time. So if we think about in the matter-dominated era, in general relativity, potential gravitational potential is static, and there is no integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. In standard general relativity, if we have cosmic acceleration at late times, that causes a decay in the potential well, which means that the photon doesn't have to climb out as much at late times, and it gets a net blue shift or a boost in the power. And this is so we get a net integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So how is the ISW affected by these modifications to the theory? Well, so they're affected by the rate of change of the two gravitational potentials. As I said, we've got an intrinsic suppression of the gravitational potentials at late time caused by the accelerated expansion. So we expect to see photons warmer than we would expect in overdense regions. if we allow this Q and R parameter to, as they increase, they're going to boost the gravitational potential that we see given for a given mass distribution. That means that effectively the photons are going to have to climb out of gravitational wells more, so they're going to be cooler than they would have been in general relativity. And so the change in the temperature will go from a boosting down to zero and then negative. And since the CMB autocorrelation spectrum is basically proportional to the temperature squared, what you're going to find is a non-monotonic response to that. So it's going to fall to a minimum when as Q and R increase slightly above unity to try and counter the suppression that was given by the accelerated expansion. This is typically seen on the scales comparable to the horizon size at the time the effect was made. So if we think about late time acceleration, we're seeing it on scales comparable with the horizon scale today. There's also an early time integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect that is caused from the presence of relativistic species when they are become non-negligible in the earlier universe. So at the time the CMB was formed, even though it's matter-dominated, there is still contribution from the relativistic species that causes the gravitational potentials at that time to decay. And so you've got an early time integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect as well. And so if we have a constant modification to the growth history here, then this is going to also impact the early integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, and we'll see it on the scales that were around horizon scale at the time CMB was formed. Okay, so again, this is for a less knowledgeable audience than this, but basically what does that mean? It means that if we're thinking about where we would expect to see these effects in the CMB power spectrum, this is roughly the size of thermalized regions at the time the CMB was formed, I should say. And so if we were going to see an early integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, we're going to see it on scales comparable with this. If we're going to think about the late time integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect, then we're going to see it on horizon scales today at these larger scales. So here are a couple of pictures just to show this. So this is the CMB predicted CMB power spectrum for late time evolving effects. So something that's it's going to be equivalent to something triggered by dark energy for increasing values of Q. And what you can see is this non-monotonic response. With Q equals zero, we're basically suppressing the gravitational potential. So that's adding to the suppression that's caused by the accelerated expansion, and we get a far boosted integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. As we increase Q, it comes down. This is general relativity. At Q equals 1.5, or roughly around that, basically the boosting of the gravitational potential well is acting to counter the suppression from accelerated expansion, and we get a minimum in the ISW, and then it starts to increase again. So the CMB alone can't tell you whether the Q or the modification is boosting or suppressing the gravitational potential. There's a degeneracy there. This is showing... Yeah, sorry.
So you use the geodesic and continuity equations, they're not modified?
They're not, so because they're just coming from the standard energy continuity, energy conservation equations.
So energy conservation is unmodified, just the Poisson equation and then the ratio of time. And then these are constant, they don't change with time?
This is evolving with time. These are the modifications that are only being triggered at late times, and that's why you're only seeing
the rest. So what is the value
that you have? 3.
Okay, good.
Yes. I'm sorry, could you just remind us what Q was? I think
Q was the modification to the Poisson equation. So basically how the potential is affected by the overdensities. But the two are I haven't shown it here, but the two effects are degenerate because basically what you're doing is just with R,
do you remember what would it be possible to just pop it on?
Yeah,
it was Q naught are not the same thing.
Right.
It's Q naught.
So let me just write down and summarize what these things are. Yeah.
Thank you.
take C, you assume it's infinite here?
Yes. So you just, I was going to ask when that slide went by, but I just.
Right, but then, no, it's just a convenient way to impose a cutoff. So at the moment, this is scale independent. So I've not put any. I'll show you the effect of adding a cutoff. Basically, what the cutoff does is basically decouple the small scale constraints from the galaxy surveys and the lensing surveys from the large scale constraints and the integrated Sex-Wolf effect. The reason for adding a cutoff of this, I mean, it's a phenomenological model, is because in a number of these theories, in the small scale regime, the deviation is, if not recovering general relativity, is suppressed in comparison to what it is in the large scales. It's just a way to parameterize that. No, and in fact, so typically you think about zeta being constant on superhorizon scales, but that's something that falls out of thinking about how the overdense, how the Einstein equations evolve on superhorizon scales. Right? So there's no reason a priori. So, you know, I will get superhorizon evolution here. And I did think about modifying that, but actually, I mean, to some extent, that's also ad hoc.
This again may not be the right time to bring this in. But there are exact solutions to Einstein's equation.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I mentioned to all the point. That's so. For example, there's a void. These models, the universe is not accelerating, and there is no dark energy. And you can fit that with some modifications to do with small amount of raw materials, and the pump will be inflation.
A large amount of massive neutrinos.
You cannot rule it out.
Extremely plenty.
So how does this fit into all of this?
So I'm assuming I've got no additional massive neutrinos. I've got a standard primordial inflationary power spectrum, and the only modification I'm looking at is a modification of the growth history. I agree there are alternative models. I think we could probably argue on different sides as to how tuned they have to be to fit the data. This...
They do. So to speak.
They can.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just considering this one model. Yeah.
So, again, this may be premature, but you can clearly use... Even here, you can set bounds on Q naught from the data, can't you?
Yes.
And they are what, 1 plus or minus?
Coming up, yeah.
Okay, all right. I said it might be premature.
That's the point of my talk. But you're right, yes. The good news is that you can. Okay, so the other thing is, if we were thinking about just a constant time independent, scale independent modification, what I was talking about was that modification would be present at earlier times when the CMB was formed, when the horizon scale is much smaller, and it basically acts to exacerbate the early integrated Sex-Wolf effect that you already get from the relativistic species. The difference now is that whereas before, when we're thinking about the late time evolution, all we've got is relatively large cosmic variance dominated constraints. At these smaller scales, the CMB is very well measured, and so we can put tight constraints on these modifications at this time using the CMB data alone. And we'll see that in a second. So I'm just trying to give you a heuristic feel for what's going on. All right, so for ISW galaxy cross correlations, what additional information can they give us? So basically what you can think about is a photon is traversing a gravitational potential well, and we'd expect that a galaxy or some large-scale halo will have formed in that gravitational well. So the benefit to this is that rather than having that degeneracy between the boosting and suppression of the gravitational potential that we saw in the ISW autocorrelations, now we get a nice monotonic change with these modifications, although we still have a problem that they're basically degenerating these two modifications with Q and R. The reason for this is that if we have a potential decaying, then you can think about the decay is going to boost the integrated Sachs-Wolfe. A decay of the potential is going to boost the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. The decay is also going to, if you're decaying potential, then you're going to assume the gravitational potential was already there, and therefore the galaxy is more likely to have formed. And so you get, you're basically going to get a positive correlation between the ISW and the galaxies in GR. But if you allow the modification to occur, then you can get a growth in the potential, so it's less likely the galaxy was there in the first place, and you get a suppression of the ISW. So you basically, as you increase this alteration, this modification, you're going to go from a positive correlation between the ISW and galaxies to a negative correlation. There's one hindrance here, which is that we don't, when we're looking at the galaxies, we're looking at the luminous matter, and we have to make some assumptions about what the bias is. That uncertainty is a hindrance, so the way in which I model this is basically following what Shirley Ho et al. Did, which is to assume a z dependence for the bias function for a given set of galaxies that's calibrated off their luminosities, and then also assume a z independent, scale independent bias factor that goes up, boosts on top of that, and then I analytically marginalize over that. I just get no information that I can get from that. That decreases the sensitivity of how well they can be used to constrain them, but as I'll show you, these are important in adding, providing additional constraints because they break this degeneracy. Okay, so here's the data that I'm using from the six survey bins from the Shirley Ho et al. Data. Basically, these are increasing, an increasing mean redshift. There are four two-mass bins and then two Sloan luminous red galaxy bins. And the curves here basically show you how the ISW galaxy cross correlation evolves with that modification. As I show you, it goes from a positive correlation down to a negative correlation as we have an increasingly strong potential for a given type of matter. What are the data points?
Points of bars.
Yeah.
They fall in different L's?
Yes, so there are different, they're from six different survey slices, so there's no reason for them to fall into the same L's. They're from six different surveys.
Usually we think of measurements at range of scales. Here you have like the scalar picked up.
Right, so these are effectively the decorrelated. This is just the choice of the decorrelated points that they, well, they're not decorrelated, they've got a covariance matrix for each of them, but these are just, I'm just showing you them, effectively the plotting points that have been used. I mean, they use a full covariance matrix in their analysis. You can also see that this is very sparsely populated at the moment, right? This is, you know, this is, the as I said, the cross correlations are relatively new because of trying to match surveys, overlapping surveys. You know, there's a few points, but even so, they're still important in providing constraints, and this is going to be an area of much improvement in the coming years, I think. Okay, finally, I just wanted to talk about how weak lensing is affected. So lensing now, rather than thinking about the time dependence of the potentials, is now just dependent on the sum of the potentials, the lensing potential. again, the autocorrelation is, well, it's not monotonic in QNR, but for, I'm going to make an assumption that R is greater than minus one. What that basically means is that light is bent inwards by a gravitational potential rather than outwards. So I'm going to impose that theoretical, but I think well-motivated prior, in which case then you've got a monotonic increase in the lensing. The advantage of this is you've got no bias thing that you have to marginalize over. But again, the two parameters are degenerate with one another. And I'm going to talk to you talk about in terms of future service how we can break this degeneracy. Okay, so finally, this is just the weak lensing data that I'm using from the COSMOS survey. It's two statistics over three redshift bins. Again, the data is relatively, well, quite poor, but just throwing it in there because it is bias independent and something that's currently available. Okay, so what are the current constraints with this data?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Your changes are scale dependent by construction, and that shows you the graph. Is that correct?
This queue at the moment is scale. All the things that I've shown you so far are just scale independent.
Independent.
Yeah.
And that shows here it's same.
Exactly. So if I was to have a scale dependent one, then it would just recover, you know, the general relativity on these small scales. Yeah. These are just for illustrative purposes. Okay, so this is the constraint, the current constraints on the time and scale independent modifications. So these are the ones where the principal constraints are coming from the earlier integrated sexual effect on degree scales in the CMB. Those are extremely well measured by the WMAP survey, and therefore the constraints are very tight. Remember, I talked before about the constraints on Newton's constant coming from nuclear synthesis to be of order 20%. Well, from the CMB alone, we can see effectively modifications to Newton's constant and how it affects the growth of structure here to be of order about 2% coming from the CMB. If we think about the late time constraints, then they're far poorer because we're principally looking at the constraints from the large-scale integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So rather than a couple of percent now, we're thinking about factors of a few. And what you can see here is this strong degeneracy between Q and R. Because they have the same effect on the CMB, on each of the data sets, you can't break the degeneracy. And I'm showing here the constraints from, this is from all the data combined. The red is if you leave out the lensing data, and the blue is if you leave out the galaxy ISW cross correlation. So see, the galaxy ISW cross actually has the most significant effect in tightening up those data.
One sigma two sigma, 6895.
So. And this is, the dotted lines just show you where GR is. So it's consistent with GR at just over one sigma. Okay, if I allow the scale, a scale-dependent modification, so I allow a cutoff in the modifications below some scale, then basically what that means is that the galaxy and the lensing data are just used to constrain general relativity, and it's only the integrated Sachs-Wolfe at late times that is constraining these modifications. And so what you see is that very long degeneracy then. So here we've got K, C equals infinity, the plot I just showed you, the scale independent ones, and then two cutoff scales of 100 megaparsecs and a gigaparsec. And so you can see it's a long degeneracy then. There's very poor constraints on the modification. Yeah, they're co-moving, yeah. No, I've marginalized over S between 0 and 3. Like that. Okay, so in terms of putting, so rather than thinking about the constraints on Q and R, it's sort of intuitive also to think about what the constraints are on the mass-power spectrum today. And so here's, again, the constraints, the marginalized 1D marginalized constraints for each K for those three cutoff scales. So no cutoff and the two cutoff scales. The black lines here, the dotted and full lines, are 1 and 2 sigma constraints for general relativity. And then the red contours are the 1 and 2 sigma constraints for the modified theory. And what it just shows you is that it allows you to suppress power on large scales. consistent, I guess, with the freedom that you have in the large-scale integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect from the CMB. Okay, I just wanted to do a quick detour for a second and talk a little bit about how that the alternative to modified gravity that I talked about, which would mimic modified gravity, which is adding in extra dark stuff into the universe that clusters. So what if instead, rather, we have general relativity, but we have an extra dark component that clusters significantly? Then we'd get a modification to the Poisson equation with some extra stuff in here that we could model as an effective Q. As I said, we wouldn't expect this to induce any extra shear stresses, so that R parameter would be 1, just like in general relativity. So we've investigated this just by, again, using a phenomenological model with some clustering scale today, a time evolution, and a cutoff, and some intrinsic scale dependence today. The reason why I'm showing you this is because you can get very different evolutions in the matter power spectrum as a result of this, or the total power spectrum. So this line here is general relativity. If you have an extra overdensity, basically what it can allow you to do is to suppress the cold dot matter perturbations, make them negative, and they can get a cancellation effect so that you get no net overdensity. And this is what's happening here in this matter power spectrum evolution. You can basically get a suppression in the total overdensity, a zero potential. So it allows you to have much more varied growth histories and much richer prediction for what the large-scale structure matter power spectrum is going to look like. As this, so the same three scenarios here are plotted in terms of how they affect the ISW, and you can see that they're relatively, because you've got this sort of oscillatory effect, the effect once you convolve those with the CMB window function or spherical bezel functions is relatively weak.
Data on rotational occurrence in galaxies.
Right, so I'm looking here with a cutoff scale that means it's not going to have any effect. It's only affecting the large scale perturbations. Obviously, if you were to carry that down to very small scales, you'd have some additional constraints. I mean, similarly so with things like tidal stripping of satellite halos and things around our galaxy, you'd have additional constraints. But what it means is that you can basically, the matter power spectrum that we think is nicely constrained is effectively wide open on large scales with the current data. And so we need large-scale surveys, additional surveys of lensing and galaxies that we can cross-correlate in order to try and break some of these degeneracies that are currently present. Okay, back to the modifications. So I just wanted to talk about the number of ways that people are describing the growth history at the moment in an attempt to think about how we can assess how good future surveys are. So one way to think about this is to describe the growth factor of how dark matter perturbations grow as a function of time relative to some reference point in the early universe, say Z of 1000. The second is to think about, and the reason you can do that is, you'd like to do that is because you can calibrate it, say, off CMB measurements or something where it's, you don't expect any modification to be present. The second is to think about calibrating off the overdensities today, and the reason for that is you could potentially directly measure this ratio from astrophysical observations. You can think about the growth rate, it's just taking the logarithmic derivative of the growth function, and the reason you want to do this is because it extracts out simple power law behavior that you can compare with predictions from general relativity. But the one that people have been really focusing on is taking the logarithm of this, so thinking about how this power law evolves as a function of how the matter evolves. And the reason people have considered this is because it's just a constant, 0.55, very roughly, at late times for general relativity. So the idea is that it could be a very easy discriminator. If you don't find gamma is 0.55, then this is maybe an evidence of something going on. So what are the constraints on these parameters from allowing these modifications? So here's the three parameters I just told you about, the growth rate relative to an early time, the growth rate relative to today, and this the growth factor, and then the growth rate. The red shows you the predictions, the constraints if you just assume a lambda CDM's history. The blue is if you allow a modified history. And what you can see here critically is that the growth rate can become negative. And so this gamma parameter that people have been using as a nice measure is not defined. So with the current data as it stands, a wider range of growth histories are available consistent with the data than can be parameterized by this gamma parameter. And so we shouldn't necessarily be using that as a way to think about testing whether surveys are going to be good at measuring this effect or not. They're not ruling out. They're saying that if you allow a freedom, then.
But then they are.
They're not
so
ruling
if you add
out.
If you add some extra parameters like Q and R,
yeah.
Then you're ruling out the model you thought was correct without those parameters.
Only 2 seconds.
Okay. Here, you're just trying to understand. Sure.
Yeah, I mean.
Okay.
Yeah. in terms of these, in terms of this, this, I mean, if you go back to Q, but at once the one sigma level is consistent with GR in terms of that Q and Q zero and R zero parameter. It's just this particular.
Well, doesn't matter. Anything, if you find anything that's off at 2 sigma, you can claim 2 sigma.
Yeah. Well, here's my perils of claiming things. So this is some work I did earlier in September looking at constraints on this R parameter from the lensing survey. If I don't assume a smoothly monotonically changing modification, but if I just allow it to suddenly shift and be boosted for a particular redshift range. And what I found was that the Cosmos data, weak lensing data, showed a better fit in its highest redshift bin if I allowed this modification. So this is what general relativity would predict, and this is the fit, the improvement in the fit and the likelihood if I allowed this modification. However, this likelihood is dependent on an estimate of the systematic errors in the survey. Obviously, if the systematic errors are underestimated, then the significance of my effect is also overplayed. And so this is exactly what was the case. So I had assumed the systematic error estimates, and this goes back to what Dragan was talking about this morning in terms of thinking about if the perils of systematic errors and trying to pick out some of these modifications or fundamental cosmological parameters we're trying to search for. In the Cosmos survey, as they predicted it in 2007, based on some simulations that they'd done of their Hubble field, they predicted that they were going to have a 6% calibration uncertainty in their shear measurements, relative calibration errors, and also a significant photometric redshift catastrophic error, which basically means your photo Zs are catastrophically misaligned with what your spectra, the true spectroscopic redshifts are. And this diagram here just gives you an estimate, gives you an illustration of this. This is what they actually saw as the distribution, the redshift distribution based on the photo Zs, and this is what they expected from the spectroscopic survey. So obviously, if you're putting low redshift galaxies at high redshifts or whatever, then you're going to be using a growth, your growth history is going to be incorrect because of those systematic errors.
You are almost guaranteed to expect lower redshifts from spectroscopic because it's hard to take spectral inductions. So you almost by default expect that those two smooth curves will differ in the way you showed.
Right.
But they are using. So but those will be different even if you.
This is what they were expecting as in terms of the true redshift. No, let me just say that. So let me assume that I'm using spectroscopic redshift as a proxy for the real redshift.
Okay.
And it was their photo Zs that were had significant. So there was a reanalysis just a few weeks after I brought out my paper, as is always the case, doing improved systematic analysis of the Cosmos field, and they found that the systematics were heavily underestimated, and so effectively the effect is gone. However, let me just now finish in the last few slides talking about what we might hope for the future. So I've shown you how important using galaxies, weak lensing, and CMB is. ISW to put constraining these modifications. In the future, there's hoped to be very much larger scale and deeper weak lensing and galaxy surveys. And there's also an aspiration that we might be able to use peculiar velocity fields as well to provide an additional data set to constrain the growth history. At the moment, peculiar velocities are effectively just removed as a systematic in order to reconstruct the power spectrum. Again, the other thing is that using cross correlations between each of these will extract out different information and help break the degeneracies between these two parameters, Q and R. And so a few years ago, we proposed one estimator using cross correlations that would allow us to do this using ratios of lensing galaxy and peculiar velocity galaxy cross correlations that would get rid of the bias factor, but also break the degeneracies between Q and R. And here's just some results that we presented at the time in comparison to thinking about future surveys, so with LSST and SKA and the JDAM concept ADEPT. These are the error bars for the surveys in three different redshift bins compared with predictions of what we might expect this ratio statistic to be for different modified gravity theories. And therefore, as you can see, there's a hope that one might be able to use those different surveys to be able to distinguish between general relativity and these modifications. And because it breaks the degeneracies between Q and R, we might be able to constrain this R parameter explicitly and therefore be able to see whether there's a smoking gun of a modification. As I mentioned, the main concern that I have for the future is trying to constrain the systematic errors to be at a sufficient level that we'll be able to look for these effects and not be fearful that it's a systematic. Instead, the key ones are looking at photometric redshift errors. but there's been a few papers over the last couple of years, the most recent one by Penji Zhang, Penn and Bernstein, looking at using cross-correlation techniques to self-calibrate the redshifts. Intrinsic alignments of lensing galaxies could morph or mimic these effects, and I'm currently working with collaborators looking at this. And then finally, peculiar velocities are a new observable if they're applied in this way, at the moment they're very, very naively modeled, and so better modeling needs to be done, N-body simulations to try and beat down the systematics on those. Okay, so just to conclude then, motivation behind this work is to try and understand the nature of cosmic acceleration and whether it's a modification to gravity or matter sectors. typically, modifications to gravity don't only modify the expansion history, but also the growth of structure, and so looking at the growth of structure can be a way to distinguish these from cosmological constant. I've shown you the current constraints. We already have constraints from the current data on these modifications, but I'm thinking this is going to be an extraordinarily exciting prospect for constraining these theories in the next 5 to 10 years with new surveys. But as I mentioned, systematics, understanding systematics is really going to be key if we're going to hope to do this. Thank you.
More questions? I was really just going to ask what, you know, whether you had a feel about something. As I say, you picked a very particular parameterization for these modifications here. So I mean, I agree, you know, when you start out with something, you have to kind of manage, get it into a manageable form. But one could imagine that in actuality these R and Q could have a very general form.
Right.
And so just because you come, you know, when the data gets a little bit firmer and you come along and say, oh, well, you know, R0 has to be 1.1 or has to be 1 because
it
can't, you know, then somebody's going to sneak around it by putting in
right.
a functional
so,
form in there.
So
what would you feel about that?
So what we're actually doing now, just following on from this, is doing thinking about starting just a principal component analysis. So that takes out the model dependence and basically talks about what are the measurable modes, what's the information that you can reconstruct from this. And the question is, what we're hoping to do is do a principal component analysis of those very basic statistics of the growth of the F and the G's. But there's that alternative, or there are other parameterizations other than the Q and the R which relate more directly to theory that we're also thinking about doing. So that's one way to take out the model dependence. Now, at the moment, you know, if you think about the principal component, you're probably going to measure one mode or something like that, right? There's not much information that's going to be there, but that's the way to be able to put current and future ones on the same footing.
So, I mean, when you wrote that down, what was it motivated by, looking at a particular example?
Well, so
it seemed to fit what was going on in the case of some new.
So, the only thing is that, you know, there are theories like the DGP model, which are largely scale independent, but have a time evolution. And that time evolution, although it's not fit by a constant index, there, you know, you could basically argue that over some given redshift range, it can be approximately constant. Similarly, you know, like I said, you know, DGP and FFR theories, basically once you start to get around the galaxy scale, start to recover, or the modifications are
depressed. In some, I mean, they're not, you're not recovering general relativity, but what I'm trying to do is just find out what the sensitivity of the data is. I'm not putting my hat on any theory.
Oh, no, I just wanted to hear what you're feeling.
Yeah, so it's really just getting, I mean, it's like the equation of state, right? I mean, we don't have an idea how the expansion history is evolving. We're just trying to use simple parameters to try and get a sense of, is there any discrepancy that we can see? So that's in this vein, basically.
Okay.
A quick detail, sort of question. You said you used CMB angular diameter distance as one of the...
Well, I used the whole CMB set, yeah.
Oh, well, that's my question. So can you, even if you didn't, are you allowed to use angular diameter distance, which of course is not an observable, or do you have to sort of redo physics of the CMB every time you run the CMB?
Yeah, I just redo it.
I see, so you have...
Let's do it can.
Right, okay.
I was just trying to dissect up.
So this is strictly, it's incorrect. Just
yes,
sorry,
yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So
one last
call.
Some of us have added enough to go all the way. Modify gravity without dark matter.
Right.
Exactly why the model theory is like fifth stage without dark matter. So if you do that, this rather changes the picture. The problem is that there's no scheme that I can see doing this where you avoid dynamics.
The
dynamical issues involved, this is why it gets quite complicated for models.
Yeah, I mean, the peculiar velocities are affected. That's definitely true. What I'm interested in is on scales. I mean, the data that I'm using here is not data that is associated with the galactic dynamics. I'm principally looking at much larger scales than that. But
there's only a way to get a way to cycles without any nasty dynamics for the universe.
Well, implicitly included in this are the dynamics in terms of the peculiar velocity fields, but not in terms of you know, non-linear flows on galactic scales. So,
what about these large peculiar velocities?
Large
controversy effect.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't generate that effect. But,
Okay, we're about to run into the next.
Right,
I'm sorry.
I think it's sensitive actually. So, on the scales you're talking about, before you growth.
So, non-linear growth is included in the weak lensing and the galaxy data here, but they, I mean, we're talking about stuff that can be. I'm not looking at sub-halo scales. I'm looking at the power spectrum on you know, 10 to 10 megaparsec plus scales. A few megaparsecs.
Okay, let's thank Rachel.
Here.